Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad that you've decided to join us today. If you live here and have lived here for any time at all, you know how big a deal the annual auto show is. For over a century, the city has celebrated its very own industry and put its cars on display at the auto show, one of the largest auto shows in North America. But it's also true that through the years, as the auto industry has shifted, the auto show has had to change too. In 1989, it was renamed the North American International Auto Show and began highlighting more global brands. And last year, the show changed again to focus on cars available in the region and move from January to September and put more of the emphasis on the tech that drives our vehicles that we drive. But all of those changes haven't necessarily been for the better. A lot of people believe that last year's show was a bit of a dud. Wasn't as crowded as shows have been in the past. There weren't as many automakers. And this year, some believe that the show is, quote, poised to disappoint again. We want to talk right now about the auto show and how it's changed over time, why it's been struggling, and how the show is reflective of changes in the industry and in our broader political economy. To do that, we have the person who coined that phrase, that the show is poised to disappoint again, with us. Jamie Butters is the executive editor of Automotive News and a co-host of the Automotive News Daily Drive podcast. He recently wrote a column about how the Detroit Auto Show is struggling and maybe not expected to be all that great this year. Jamie Butters, welcome back to Detroit Today.
Good morning, Stephen. Good to be here.
Also, just a heads up, Detroit Today did reach out to the auto show, the folks who run it, and they sent us a statement. And I'll start the conversation there. It says, quote, "The Detroit Auto Show is part of the fabric of the city, and just like Detroiters, we keep moving forward. The 2023 Detroit Auto Show will have more vehicles and new experiences for our guests, all of which benefit our industry, the city of Detroit, and our great state of Michigan." That was from Rod Alberts, who is the executive director of the Detroit Auto Dealers Association that puts on the auto show. They did say that they would have someone come and talk with us a little later in the summer when we get closer to the auto show's beginning, which is going to be in September this year. So, Jamie, I am going to come to you now and have you react to what Rod says in that statement. Your column kind of takes a different tack on what's going on with the auto show.
Well, what I like about that statement is he doesn't say anything that's demonstrably untrue. And my biggest issue, and part of a big reason I wrote the column, was because their initial press release about this September show said there were going to be double the brands that there were last year. Because, as you pointed out accurately in the opening, there wasn't as much brand participation as there traditionally has been. We really had the Detroit 3 with their 12 brands that they sell in the U.S. and Toyota and Subaru. So, and then there were a number of brands that were represented just by local dealers, or like, you know, local Honda, Acura, BMW. We don't want to miss out entirely. Let's at least put a car from our lot onto the show floor so that there's some representation. So I was like, well, how are you going to double? I mean, who's coming back? Are you getting the Koreans? Are you getting, you know, who's coming? And there were no answers, and it just didn't make sense. So I sent my reporters, we sent our reporters out, Michael Martinez and a bunch of the other reporters who cover automakers. And, you know, almost every brand said that wasn't there last year, said they aren't coming back this year. And Subaru, which was one of the two non-Detroit brands, said it's not going to have a stand. So, like, it's not going to double. The show's answer was sort of like, well, we mean you have to include the brands that dealers bring. Well, you already had those last year. So the only, you know, it's it, the only way that statement makes sense is if you're counting apples 1 year and all fruit the next, and it's just not honest. And so, look, it's a challenge to do this show, and you know, I want it to succeed. But if we're not honest about what the situation is, what isn't working, then nothing can be done to fix it.
So I want to go back 12 months, maybe a little longer, and talk about the real anticipation that I think a lot of people had about the 2022 show. That was the first show that was going to be held in the fall instead of January. It also had been a few years, of course, before, but since we had been able to have, you know, the regular show because of the pandemic, there was a lot of hoopla about the things that were changing and how this would be a much better show from an experiential point of view. Not many people said it would be a bigger show, but certainly the expectation was that this was going to jumpstart the idea of the show and send it careening positively into the future. So I want to talk about what happened last year and how that maybe spills over into what we're dealing with as we anticipate this year's show.
Yeah, you know, so last year, you always have to think about auto shows, right, in sort of two phases. There's the media portion, you know, which used to be very important. It's much less of a big deal around auto shows now. They've really refocused back into consumer shows. Detroit really leaned into that. And they had some things that kind of seemed to work, or it seemed like they could be appealing. Of course, you know, a lot of us took selfies with the giant inflatable duck. There were a lot of test drives being done. There were demonstrations of new technology, hovercraft and things like that. So, you know, there were some interesting things, but, you know, clearly it was a disappointment because they would not, at the end of the show's run, acknowledge how many people attended. Right. And that's just something that's just standard. If you have a trade show and it's, you know, backed by taxpayer funds, among other things, and just to share what's going on, it's always something you do at those shows. Detroit used to pull in, you know, close to 1 million people a year, many hundreds of thousands. They were hoping for like 500,000. You know, it was almost certainly quite a bit less than that. But we're not going to know how small it was and how we're building from it without having a clear sight into who actually attended and how paltry was it.
Let's talk about the experiential differences that they injected into the show last year. I was pretty excited about those. Did that do what they wanted it to do for the show? And why did they feel like that was the thing that was needed? I mean, one of the things that's of course changing in the background is the nature of auto shows themselves and the rise of these tech shows that show off all the things that work inside your car. They have become huge. And so the whole idea of the auto shows kind of grabbing center stage has been tougher. What was it about making it almost like more like an amusement park, I guess, that they thought would attract more people to the show than we had in the past?
Yeah, I'm curious what it was that had you excited exactly. I mean, but there definitely was an attempt for some amusement park type environment. You had the giant duck. There were dinosaurs walking around. You know, people in costumes as dinosaurs and dinosaur theme in one area, and that was an interesting choice. I think, you know, there was sort of probably the hope that hey, it'll be fun for the kids, and then it can be a whole family day. But it also, you know, led to some snarky jokes, right, about the dinosaur being full of it, or the industry being full of dinosaurs, or needing more dinosaurs to get more oil to power the cars. That was a interesting move.
Yeah.
I think, but you know, we also had the big, you know, structured, you know, mountains and hills for the you know, Fords and Jeeps and things to climb over and give people some of those kinds of experiences. And then, of course, the EV drives around in and out of the show and the show floor. And those, I think those are successful. They tend to be you know, have long lines. People are really eager to partake of them. I think sometimes they're disappointed they don't get to drive the electric cars. They more often just get to ride in them. But at least it gives you a chance for some familiarity if that's, you know, something you're looking for, as a lot of consumers are. You know, most people don't have an EV. And it's only 7% of sales so far this year about. And so, but there are a lot of people who are curious, who are interested. And auto shows can be a great place to gain some familiarity, be able to ask some questions, not feel like you're in a high pressure situation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of opportunity for educational you know, experiences at auto shows.
So what about these tech shows? The big one in Vegas is, you know, many multiple times the size of our auto show and is just gaining popularity. It feels like every year there's more and more people who want to go. And of course, there are more and more developers and manufacturers who want to show off what they're doing at these shows. Is that what's killing the auto show as much as anything that we do to change this particular auto show to be more appealing?
Well, it's very much what killed this auto show. You know, from what it was as a beginning of the year, you know, major international event. Really, by the traditional newsworthiness standards, CES has become the world's preeminent auto show. It's one of the few where you might see CEOs from, you know, the U.S., Europe, Asia, all at one place. It's where I think it had the most, you know, concept car reveals of any show, you know, outside of China, you know, in the past since COVID. This last year, I mean, we had that's where the Ram EV was shown. And the reason I say that CES is what killed Detroit was, you know, it also came right at the beginning of the year, and it just became such a bigger show, a sexier show in some ways. And then really the straw that broke the camel's back to me, I guess it was an earlier straw than the final one, but was when GM decided to reveal the Bolt. You know, the Bolt EV was a breakthrough car for GM, giving them something to try to compete with the Model 3. In hindsight, maybe not as cool, not as much sizzle, but, you know, a really important, a statement vehicle from GM. And they revealed it at CES and then came to Detroit to do a technical briefing about it. And it just showed that CES had taken over that spot. The conundrum for Detroit, right? It's like, well, you want to be important. You want to still get reveals. Like, I mean, last year, the Mustang reveal, that was hot. That was really, that was a big night in Detroit. The problem was the actual show day the next day just couldn't carry the momentum through. Nobody had any vehicles to reveal. CES has just really taken it over. What we had in January, though, was a lot of habits, you know, school districts putting kids in buses to come down, you know, engineers who would come down for industry day to check out the competitive vehicles and, you know, what their, you know, suppliers checking out what their competitors got to sell to somebody. So, you know, a real pattern of behavior when there weren't a lot of other entertainment alternatives, you know. And I dig what, you know, they were trying to do with a move to June or September, trying to make it more a part of the other, you know, fun things there are to do in Michigan. But the reality is we all only have so much time and so much money. And when it's September in Michigan, like, there's a lot of stuff to do. There's mm-hmm. Michigan football. There's still Tigers baseball. There's Michigan State, right? We've got college mm-hmm. football, pro baseball. Up north is still fun and beautiful. Like, it's just a lot to compete with. It's tough.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to keep talking with Jamie Butters, the executive editor of Automotive News, about the auto show. We're going to expand the conversation just a little to talk about some of the broader political and economic implications that are roiling the auto industry right now. And of course, then having an effect on the city of Detroit and our region. Also want to get going with you on the phones. What do you make of the change to the Detroit Auto Show? Did you go last year? What did you make of all of the differences Do you care that there weren't as many automakers at that show? They're showing off the cars that they're making. Has the thing changed over time in a way that you think makes it less exciting than it was? Or are you somewhat more excited? Also, give us a sense of what you're thinking about cars. What do you think about the price of cars? What do you think about these new EVs? All of the things that are really changing right now inside the industry. 313-577-1019 is always the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDETM. Stephen Henderson, and thanks for tuning in. We're talking right now with Jamie Butters. He is the executive editor of Automotive News and co-host of the Automotive News Daily Drive podcast. He recently wrote a column about how the Detroit Auto Show is, quote, poised to disappoint again. The show faces a number of challenges and has for many years. Was supposed to get a jump start last year from a major revamp that didn't really happen, and there has been more news this summer that the show may get even smaller than it was before. We would love to hear from you during the conversation as well, not just about the auto show and its changes, but also about the auto industry and its changes. What do you make of all of the things that look really different about our cars, how we buy them, how we drive them, how we fuel them, than we used to do, not in the too distant past. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can make you part of the show that way. Jamie, I want to talk about what before we get to the kind of broader industry questions, I want to talk a little more about what you think the possibility or maybe the opportunity is for the show to fill some of these gaps that have opened up and actually pull off a show that moves us into a more certain future for NAIAS.
Well, I'm not a show organizer, but if I were to pretend to play one on TV, I mean, I think there's a couple of key things, right? You've got to find a way, you got to make sure you get like full participation from the Detroit Three, right? Detroit's a tough market for international automakers, right? So many of us here, people work for the automakers, they work for the suppliers, they get friends and family discounts, or they're just, you know, loyal because this is the industry that built Detroit, right? So it's hard for a Toyota or a Hyundai or a BMW to really move the needle on market share. So I think they've got to kind of really lean into the Detroitness, maybe get, sounds crazy, but like UAW involvement in a positive way. Hopefully we don't see a lot of UAW protests during this year's show. But, you know, it's like, I think you really want to focus on it, say, hey, it's a company town. This is the Motor City, and this is the Detroit Three's backyard. And I almost would envision like a combined company picnic, right? The other thing I think for auto shows generally, right, there's just such a huge gap between what American consumers know about electric vehicles and automated driving and what people in the industry know. And I feel like there's a great opportunity to build like the Museum of Science and Industry, right, in Chicago or LA, and have those kinds of displays that can really teach people, well, how do we get what are batteries made of, right? And where do we get those minerals from, and how are they processed, and how are they treated at the end of the vehicle's life? How do you charge a vehicle? You know, what are your options at home? What are your options on the road? Obviously, these things are going to evolve over time, but they seem like things that could be explained and that people would be interested in might be willing to pay money and go to learn about. And the third thing is, and I've heard this idea, I'm going to be exploring it more on my podcast soon, but you know, there's so much shopping that can be done online.
Sure.
That you can really make an auto show if you're walking around with your phone or even an iPad, but really even just your own phone, you could almost buy the car right off the floor, right? Or you can compare it to everything else. So I think there's making that digital shopping part of the auto show experience is another way that shows can really remain relevant and lean into their role in serving consumers to find the products they need.
Okay. So I do want to switch to talking about some of the broader things going on in the industry, because there is a lot of change. And I want to start with a couple of comments that we've gotten on social media during the show. Dave on Twitter says, I don't attend anymore because I couldn't care less about new vehicles. New trucks and SUVs cost $800 to $1,500 a month these days. And as a one-income household, new vehicles aren't an option. In my 20s, I dreamt about new cars. Now in my 40s, I'm trying to keep costs down. Stacy on Twitter says, I'm just going to say this. Maybe the intense samifying of car models takes a lot of the fun out of the experience for the average person. There's not a single road trip where I don't spend long minutes complaining about how one distinctive makes look the same sad same. That's two comments that I think really hit not just on the trouble that the show may be having, but also things that are happening in the industry that change the way we think about cars, which of course then drives our interest in the show itself. So let's start with the things that are changing with tech and the cost that comes along with that, and what that means, not just for our listener, David, but for everybody. And mm-hmm. whether we're headed to a space where cars are becoming, a new car is becoming something of a luxury that many, many people won't really get to experience.
Yeah, affordability is such a challenge for the industry and for the American consumer. It wasn't that long ago that, you know, regular working class people could buy a new car. There were new car options in the price ranges that, you know, the average family could afford. That has really been skewed during the pandemic times and the chip shortage. It'll be interesting to see how it adjusts relative to average wages going forward. You know, we're already starting to see some adjustment in the mix, right? When the industry could make only, you know, 70% or 80% of the vehicles they wanted to, there was such over demand that they just said, okay, we're going to do only the top of the line so we can sell them all for the highest price and the highest profit. And the profits showed it. The automakers made record profits. Auto dealers made record profits. And now there's more chip supply. There's more throughput coming through the factories. Not everybody can buy, you know, a $65,000 truck mm-hmm. or a $50,000 sedan. So we're starting to see a little more evening out of the mix. More of the base level models are being manufactured and put on the lots. We're starting to see some incentives come back. I mean, for a long time, the average transaction price was even higher than the MSRP, the manufacturer's suggested retail price. And, you know, that was unheard of before, except for, you know, the occasional super, super hot model. So, you know, affordability is a big concern, and especially with interest rates getting higher, you know, there's some thinking about a model where maybe more of the vehicles are sold to people in the top quintile of earners, the top fifth of incomes, but because they last so much longer mm-hmm. and can be updated over the air, that when other people buy, you know, second and third hand cars, they're getting much better second and third hand cars than ever existed before.
Can you talk just a little about the relationship between the tech boom, I guess, that is changing the way that the cars are built and the way they function, and this cost issue? Is it that we are adding so much to what we expect from cars and expect them to do that is raising the price, or is there something else that's making them as expensive as well?
I mean, you're not wrong that the safety tech and the infotainment systems that we have, they add cost. They add, you know, hundreds of dollars, maybe even thousands or a thousand or two to different vehicles. The most important, I mean, the most expensive component on any vehicle on the road now is the battery in an electric vehicle. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge part. You know, we have really the two main forces are raising prices is, you know, the high cost of batteries for electric vehicles. So almost all, you know, we saw the Tesla model, right? If you are making EVs and they have these super expensive batteries, start by selling super expensive cars and then try to bring the prices down as you can bring your costs down. So that's, working where we are in the adoption of EVs, we're getting a lot of expensive cars, even, you know, cars that look like compact, you know, crossovers, regular, you know, family cars, they're $50,000 and $55,000, you know, if they're electric or more. And hopefully they stay under the federal, you know, EV tax credit limits. But then the other thing is just, you know, look, people like trucks, they like big SUVs. They want all the technology, the other big force. One is the cost of EVs and batteries, and the other is just scarcity. And in the face of scarcity, businesses raise prices as long as consumers are willing to pay them. And there have been, you know, easily the whatever 12 to 13 million Americans willing to pay a lot of money, more than Dave, you know, for a new vehicle. And hopefully over the coming year or two, maybe three, we get more new vehicle options out there for folks like Dave, and we get more good used vehicles out there. I mean, the problem, we produce so few vehicles for the last 2-3 years, mm-hmm. that there is going to be a scarcity of good used cars for, you know, half a decade.
What about Stacy's concerns about the way the cars look? And that she says, you know, the era of distinctive models is somehow gone. Is the tech focus, is it subduing design, which used to be, of course, kind of our bread and butter here in Detroit at the Detroit three automakers?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm you know, you can go back to the 90s and see a lot of copycat vehicles and all the pickups started to look alike, all the minivans started to look alike, all the sedans started to look alike. There definitely is, you know, within the EV trends, you know, everybody's going with the same super aerodynamic design. You know, she's not wrong. There's a lack of creativity in for the most part, because, you know, people want to be safe. It's why, you know, hamburgers usually come with, you know, ketchup, mustard, and pickles, I guess, you know, because they just aim for the middle, give them the vanilla ice cream. I think there is some, you know, we are seeing some more unique designs. I mean, the GMC Hummer EV, obviously, you know, the Celestiq is sort of a super high-end Cadillac. I think the Ioniq 6, you know, is a really beautiful car. It's kind of, It's shorter than a Beetle, and it's a little bigger and more useful than a, you know, Porsche 911, but it has that sort of curvy look that's really distinctive on the road. But, you know, it is part of the value proposition, right? And if you feel like you want a car that looks distinctive and special, maybe you don't want to pay $50,000, you know, or $40,000 for a sedan that looks like every other sedan. Mm.
We're talking with Jamie Butters. He is the executive editor of Automotive News and co-host of the Automotive News Daily Drive podcast. He recently wrote a column about the Detroit Auto Show and how it is, quote, poised to disappoint again. We're talking not just about the show, but about the auto industry, all the things going on, all the things changing in the auto industry and how that affects us as well as the auto show. Love to hear from you on the phones and on social. 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you in the conversation that way. Jamie, I want to talk about a story that I saw today in one of the newspapers about the upcoming contract talks in the industry and the anticipation that we could have an an auto strike, and that the UAW may walk out. Let's talk about what that would mean and how that fits into, again, the narrative of change in the industry, costs and design and all of these things that that drive how we choose the vehicles that we're going to buy.
Yeah, there's a widespread expectation that there will be at least one strike by the UAW, very likely a strike also by the Canadian Union Unifor, which will be negotiating simultaneously. Very interesting times. You know, I think a lot of it with the UAW, you have a lot of factors pulling them in that direction, right? They've got a new president who's been very confrontational in his rhetoric. Of course, he's trying to restore the union leadership's credibility after a massive bribery scandal that sent two former presidents to prison, however briefly, and several other people as well. So he's got to show that he's not, you know, in the pocket of the companies. Plus, you know, you've got workers who are well compensated, you know, but they agreed to a contract in 2019, and then COVID hit, and we saw, you know, huge inflation and huge profits by the automakers. And they get profit sharing. It's not like they don't get a part of that, but they maybe feel like they should have gotten more, and they maybe feel a little less well off compared to inflation, compared to the price of goods and services than they did 4 years ago. So they want to make up for that. And you've just seen a rise in labor around the country. You know, the UAW has just had several strikes that have followed, you know, contract talks that haven't gone smoothly. And then they end up getting a deal and they seem happy with it. So I think they feel like that's a useful tool. And there's very little reason to think they won't use it when the time comes.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number. Let's go to Harry in Sterling Heights. Harry, welcome to the show.
Yes, I'm an old guy. I'm a big car fan. Why is everything an SUV nowadays? When I was a kid, we had a station wagon. People made fun of us. Hey, your dad's got a station wagon. And now they're collector's items. And then everything now is an SUV. My wife and I are retired. All we need is a two-door to get us point A to point B. They don't build any more two-door coupes, nothing with styling, and everything's got four doors, and it's an SUV.
Yeah, Harry, cars are definitely bigger now than they used to be, and by that I mean that on average, the cars that they're making are much bigger than the ones that we used to drive and want the industry to make. In the 70s and 80s, the obsession then with fuel efficiency and things like that led cars to be much smaller. Jamie, what is the explanation for why right now, Harry's right, almost everything that's for sale is some sort of SUV, or as they call it, a crossover, which I always think, well, that's just a small SUV, but it's still an SUV.
Yeah, I mean, there are different explanations of SUV, but the main reason is when you ask consumers what they want, most of them want an SUV. So most of them are getting little station wagons, called crossovers. I mean, to me, one of the big differences, at least used to be a big difference, and a difference was it was maybe an SUV if it was a body-on-frame vehicle built in the way that a pickup is made. And they would be, you think about an early Bronco, and all that, or I guess even today's Broncos, but you think back to the early SUVs, right? They were built like trucks, and people like that image. So then we got these crossovers that were cooler than station wagons, but basically trying to capture that utility, that usefulness. But people said, well, I want an SUV, but I want better mileage. Like, oh, well, take this crossover utility vehicle. And they call them, most brands will call them SUVs, even if they're, not much bigger than a compact car. But if it's not shaped like a sedan, they'll call it an SUV. Mm-hmm. Because that's what people put in their Google searches.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones here. Todd in Lake Orion. Todd, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Appreciate the conversation. Mm-hmm. Two quick things, and tied in somewhat to the auto show. and you appreciate you having an expert on. I'm glad you brought up the Ford Bronco. God bless Ford. I'm sure they're trying to do their best. But anybody that's been involved in the ordering of the Ford Broncos and the best of luck approach that I feel Ford has taken with this, I just wanted to know if your expert could shed any light. Is this ever going to get any better? I mean, have they fumbled this so poorly that I just feel, and I'm still on the list. You know, I put my name in there. I put in my order. I want one. I'm going to ride it out for as long as I possibly can. But just someone of an outsider's opinion, how did Ford mess this up? And I realized the COVID, it was terrible timing.
Sure.
You know, the trim packages and all the things that they've done. But I just want someone's open and honest opinion. How did Ford mess this up so badly?
Todd, before we get back to Jamie, how long have you been waiting?
Oh, well over a year.
Oh, wow. My goodness. Well, I hope you get your car soon, because they are pretty cool, and I know lots of people who are driving them who like them quite a bit. Jamie, what's the answer? And we haven't talked much about supply chain, which I know has something to do with what's going on there. Todd's waiting a year for a new Bronco. Is that a fatal error on Ford's part?
No, it's just it's a bummer. It's a bit of a miscalculation, but it's so hard to tell when you have when there's a really popular vehicle being developed, right? Because right away they could have sold 500,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you build enough capacity to sell 500,000, to build 500,000 in a year, are there going to be another 500,000 buyers the next year and the next year and the next year? They have to be able to run it out over at least, you know, 5 years, if not 10. And so then when they end up with something that's so popular, they clearly got the design right. They got a lot of the tech right, and just got so many people signing up that, yeah, huge waits. There's also, you know, if you want to get the Maverick hybrid, it's a huge wait for that one too. I don't know. Todd doesn't seem satisfied, but I do know that with the Bronco customers, they've made pretty extraordinary efforts to keep in touch with them, to say, you know, sending little gifts, you know, I don't know, a compass or a scarf or whatever, a water bottle, you know, thank you for ordering a Bronco. We're still thinking of you, and we still care. You know, it's tough. And so, you know, it's great business because they can sell all of them for top dollar. People want to load them up with everything, but you don't want people having to wait. And we've seen it at Tesla too, right? And people had to wait, people who camped out to order the Model 3 sight unseen on the first day it went on sale. And some of those people had to wait a couple of years. So it's not without precedent, but it's not without disappointment. It's, you know, you just, as a company, you don't want to put, you know, loyal, enthusiastic customers through that kind of misery. But it is part of what happens when you have a successful vehicle.
Will the supply chain open back up to the point where this is less of a nuisance for buyers? The Chips and Science Act, of course, is a nod in that direction, but it'll take some time, I think, for that to actually have the effect that's intended. But will we get to a point where these kind of waits for vehicles are not as common?
Yes, absolutely. Production is already, you know, back to nearly full swing at all the plants in North America and most around the world. Obviously, we still have war in Eastern Europe that is limiting production in, you know, Germany and places like that, places to the east of there, but, you know, North American production is back in full swing. It's a lot healthier for the suppliers. We have worked with one of the companies, Auto Forecast Solutions, you know, ever since the chip shortage became kind of a crisis. They would tell us each week, okay, how many vehicles were cut from production plans and how many they project will be cut over the year. And last year was less bad than 2021. This year it's projected to be less bad than 2022. And in fact, even just in the past month, they reduced their outlook for lost production due to lack of chips. So, you know, and what the manufacturing executives and people keep saying is that through the chip crisis, they learned a lot better what they can do to secure supply, how to communicate better, how to balance the needs of different factories better, and maybe they can be more resilient and continue, you know, throughput. We're seeing inventories build up at least a little on dealership lots. So yeah, prices should start coming down and weights should start coming down. But of course, the exceptional, you know, handful of super popular vehicles, there's going to be a wait.
Okay, Jamie Butters, executive editor of Automotive News. Always really great to have you here with us on Detroit Today. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about the auto show and the auto industry.
Glad to do it.
When we come back, we're going to keep talking about auto-related matters, but we're going to specifically pivot to traffic accidents, which have gotten worse in the state over the last 3 years, specifically fatal traffic accidents. State Representative Tyrone Carter, a Democrat from Detroit, is going to join us to discuss. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.